Okay, welcome back, everyone. I'm Chandler, and you're tuned into BME Radio. Today's show is about the practice of castration and penectomy, so sensitive listeners should probably not listen this week. Most of what we'll be talking about will be upsetting to some of you. The thing to remember here is that everything we're talking about is consensual and is making the people involved happy. That said, we've got Marcel, also known as Nulla1, here in the studio with us. Marcel is a smoothie, which means not only has he been castrated, but his penis has also been removed, as have his nipples, giving him the look of a Ken doll. I'll repeat here that this was all voluntary and, more importantly, all sane. Marcel, I'll ask you the more gory details later, but first let's set the groundwork a little. Outside of this side of your life, What sort of a guy are you? What have you done other than what we're talking about right now?
Well, besides the body modification, I'm very much into tattoos. Mm-hmm. I started that about maybe...
I'm asking more about your professional history as much as you are comfortable talking about it.
Well, I retired. I'm not working anymore. I retired mm-hmm. about 8 years ago. And then I was a financial accountant for a big company, and then that's it.
But educated and normal and
oh,
not...
Oh, yes. I did my university from 1957 to 1961. I graduated, and then I found some work in Montreal, and I've been living there since 1961. But in 1999 or end of 1998, I moved to Toronto for good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your childhood and youth were totally
just
normal?
Just very normal, you mm-hmm. know. there's absolutely nothing I can say about it. It was just, you know, the normal childhood with a brother, two sisters, and very normal.
And you're the only one of them that took this path.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, my brother is straight, but he knows about that I am gay, but he doesn't know about my body modifications.
Although you're coming more and more public as time goes by.
Yes.
So yeah. He'll stumble upon it, I think.
Well, that I don't care.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Now, when did you actually come out? Was that early in life or later on?
Later. I came out at the age of 21.
Oh, so it was fairly early still.
Well, most of the people I know at 13, 14, they know exactly that they are gay.
Oh, you didn't actually even...
No.
You weren't even sure yourself.
No, no. I dated girls, and I had fun with them, but I never had any sexual intercourse with the girls, but because I was born and raised in the Catholic religion, and you were not supposed to have sex with your partner... before marriage, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but once in Montreal, I just by hazard, I had sex with a man, and then I knew.
how do you accidentally have sex with a man?
Well, I was at the party, and I was quite drunk, and that guy took me to his place,
mm-hmm.
and then we had sex together, you know. I loved it. That's the how I learned, you know, I was gay. I wasn't straight anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I was attracted by men.
Right. And then for a while, I assume you led a pretty normal gay life. And then...
Oh, yes. It was what we call very much a vanilla sex, you mm-hmm. know, just a normal sex between two men.
Mm-hmm.
Till 1970, when I joined a leather club. And then now I knew what was S&M, you know,
mm-hmm.
and all those things. And I even had a bike, a motorbike, from 1974 to 1976. And belonging to a leather club, I visited other clubs like the Spearhead in Toronto, clubs in Boston, New York, Washington, Cleveland, Chicago, and... I got involved with the S&M activities, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What were some of those for people that don't really know that scene?
Well, it was top and bottoms, you know, master and slaves.
Mm-hmm.
But I was definitely marked by one guy in particular in New York City. He belonged to a club, a leather club of that town, and he was the first man I saw with small gold nipple rings.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it was such a shock. And I couldn't believe it. It was so nice. I was absolutely jealous of that man, you know. And this was back in 1973, 74. Mm-hmm. And piercing was not popular at all.
I think what Gauntlet opened first in, what, 76, was it?
It's possible. Mm-hmm. But that guy was obviously a top, and he was probably a Cuban or Puerto Rican. His look was a kind of a god, you know, very dark complexion, you know, and absolutely gorgeous looking with those two gold nipple rings. It was absolutely awesome.
Mm-hmm. And then he did yours, or?
No. After that, I tried to pierce myself in 1976 just using a sewing needle, you know, mm-hmm. a big one. And although it was absolutely painful, I succeeded, you know, to get my first nipple ring.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You have a lot more piercings now.
Well, not too many, because no genital piercings, of course.
Well, you have genital piercings in a jar.
Yes. Well, I used when I had all my parts. Mm-hmm. I had the PA. Well, first I started with a frenum.
Yeah.
This is the easiest piercing, I think. And then I had a Prince Albert, which I did myself. Then a friend of mine did the Ampalang, and I did myself the Apadravia.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my genital piercings.
Okay. We're gonna play a little bit of music, and when we come back, we'll start talking to Marcel about ball torture and how that led into his castration. You probably know this next band from their hit Kelly Watch the Stars, but this is off a reissue of some early material. This is Air.
Thank you.
Okay, we're back with Marcel here. We'll quickly ask you to define what it is, because I think that some of the people listening won't really understand the idea behind it. What is ball torture?
Well, it's inflicting pain to your balls, you know,
mm-hmm.
and to a point that the pain just become exquisite, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's not a horrible experience. It's
oh, not at all. Mm-hmm. No. Ball torture can consist of, you know, many form of tortures, you know. You can put a parachute, you know, around your scrotum.
What's a parachute for people who
it's
don't know?
It's a little parachute about, I would say, maybe 3 to 4 inches in diameter.
Mm-hmm.
And you put that around your balls, and it's cut, so it fits very well
right.
around your balls. And then you put it in place by snaps, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's a little chain, three chains hanging, and it's end up with a hook, so you can add weights.
So it's sort of like a little skirt for your scrotum.
Yes.
Right.
And then you can add weights
mm-hmm.
there,
mm-hmm.
you know. See, this is a form of torture. You can also insert needles mm-hmm. in your balls. I've know many guys who likes that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you can also whip your balls, you know, spank your balls, punch your balls, you know, use your feet, you know, and hit your balls, you know, all kind of torture, you know. It's just use your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. According to the receiver is likes it, you know.
Of course.
Yes, of course.
Now, how do you get into that in the first place? I mean,
it's hard to tell, but probably it happened when the guy started to squeeze my balls, you know, and the pain was just pleasant, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it started, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's a massive subculture dedicated to ball torture, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. It's called CBT,
mm-hmm.
cock and ball torture. Yeah.
Now, I was talking to the owner of Chase Union yesterday, and what he said, he's a sort of ball torture proponent, but not really a castration proponent. And he said, you know, they're so much fun. There's so much fun to torture. Why would you ever want to take them off?
Well, in my case, what happened one day, I was alone and I was horny. So I just smoked a joint and with poppers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I put the parachute around my balls and I started to put on weight. And I started with 5, then I went to 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, and then it felt good, you know, and with the poppers, I couldn't feel any pain, you know, it was just pleasant, exquisite, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then I put 45, 50, 55, 60, and 65, 70, 75, and then I put 80 pounds, and then I chickened out. I said, no way, I'm just going to kill myself if I carry on like that, you know, and I stopped.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was enough. Because I have seen in one of the drummers, a guy said he could take 120 pounds.
I've seen guys take 300 pounds.
Oh, boy. So, I was afraid, you know, to hurt my mm-hmm. cords, mm-hmm. you know, inside my body, you know. And I would have to go to hospital. Then how would you explain that? So after that, I never went up more than 40 pounds. I could easily put 40 pounds and jerk off with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the problem is that to reach a climax, I had to go through those things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty scary at the end.
It sounds almost like when drug addicts have to take more and more drugs to...
That's it. Yeah. That's right.
So you think that the ball torture directly led to your castration interest?
I think so, too, because I'm the type of person that will overdo things.
But you don't think that you overdid things. I mean, you're very happy with what you've done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
Now, how did you even first realize that castration was possible for you? Did you meet other people who'd been castrated?
No, but I remember back in probably 1985, 86, I saw an ad in Drummer about a club dedicated to a man into genital modification, especially castration. And this is how I got involved with...
This was a Unique magazine?
I think in those days it was Unique.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So I became a member, and I had a few pen pals. So this is how I discovered about castration, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then you started actively trying to track down a cutter? What was the next step?
Not at that point. in between, I know you were just about to ask me the question. In between, in 1988, I discovered that I was HIV positive, you know. And for a year or two, I was in a very depressive mood. I quit that Unique club, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And because, let's put it this way, in those days, a person... who was positive would die within 2 years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty scary in those days.
And it's been, 15 years now?
I know. So, I started to take medication, and then the T4 cell count was pretty steady, about 265, 300. And in those days, I was taking AZT.
Mm-hmm.
And that kept me going, you know, because it was the only medication for AIDS, you know. Anyway, I survived my depression. And then probably in 1992... or 91, I saw another ad in Drummer for Enigma.
Mm-hmm.
This was the same kind of club for men into body modification, and it was based in Chicago. I know the owner, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then, again, I became a member, and then I just had pen pals there, you know, many pen pals. And the thing is that in 1993, I went to Provincetown, Cape Cod, and I met one of the members of the club there. And he showed me pictures, three pictures of guys being modified. You know, one had his cog head removed. Another one was, he had been castrated. And the third picture, the guy was a smoothie, absolutely no genitals at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that was such a turn on for me, you know. I said, well, I have been thinking of castration for, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years. I thought it was a fantasy, but now I realize this is more and more serious, you know. And then I asked that member, I said, who did those modifications? Oh, he says, it's a guy that I know of. I said, well, can I get in touch with him? Oh, he said, yes, I can give you his name if you want. That was in June of 1993.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote to that guy, or if you want to call it a cutter, you know. And he replied to me, and we started a correspondence. And then I told him about my desire to be castrated. Well, he said, there's no problem there. The only thing to do is just come over here and don't come alone. Bring a friend with you, your closest friend. Don't come alone, because you will need a person that you trust with you. So we... decided that I would go there in the month of September to get castrated. And I went. And he met me at the bus station with my friend. It was about 5 o'clock. And at 8 o'clock, he started the procedure on me. That was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I was nervous, absolutely nervous. I was a nervous wreck.
I'm sure.
Because... I started to ask myself what I have done, you know. And I'm not the type of person to back up when I have given my word. Unless I'm proved the contrary, I'm wrong, I will keep my word and do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it took about 2 hours, or I would say an hour and 45 minutes to castrate me. There was no problem, absolutely almost no bleeding, you know. And he used an anesthetic like Xylocaine, and there was absolutely no pain involved.
Mm-hmm. This person, they were not a doctor. They were, I mean, what sort of background does this cutter have?
Well, he had no medical background. He never studied medicine, but he checked the medical books, mm-hmm. and he knew exactly what to do. And then I wasn't the first one he mm-hmm. castrated, so I could trust him, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. We're going to play some, some Anthony Phillips off of a CD that Marcel brought. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about Marcel's further modifications. All right, we're back. Now, Marcel, when you were first castrated, they removed both testicles, and yes. they left the scrotum at that point.
Yes, they left the scrotum. Yeah,
and you went for a while as a.
Well, that was in September of 1993, and then the next modification took place in May of 1994, and this time it was the penectomy.
Mm-hmm. That's a lot heavier duty procedure. What was involved in that?
What do you mean?
How was that procedure done? And
it's very complicated, and it's a very delicate procedure, and you have to know what you're doing, mm-hmm. you know.
And at that point, you had actually more like a partial penectomy done. You still had about an inch stub at that point?
After the penectomy, mm-hmm. yeah, there was about half an inch stump mm-hmm. left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there was still erectile tissue in it. And
exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. What were, castration, you know, you take hormones afterwards and you're still pretty much the same person, but penectomy is a pretty radical change to who you are and your sexual identity. What was the, you know, what sort of thinking did you do leading up to that? And
well, let's put it this way. When I was in the S&M, I was top for a while, and mm-hmm. then I switched to bottom, you know. So after that, being a bottom, I was rather French active and Greek passive. Mm-hmm. I don't know if... Should I explain what it is?
Yeah, sure, explain it for people.
Okay. So French active means... sucking cocks, mm-hmm. you know, and Greek passive, it means that you like to be fucked, mm-hmm. you know. So at that point, I never had any great pleasure having or getting a blowjob, you know. Mm-hmm. And on the contrary, I enjoy very, very much being fucked, you mm-hmm. know. So after that, my penis was more or less useless, mm-hmm. you know what I mean. So this is one of the reasons I decided to go for the penectomy, you know.
Mm-hmm. So it didn't actually change your sexual behavior that much at all?
Not at all. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, not at all. Mm-hmm. No.
And you still enjoy sex? There's pleasure through the prostate? And
oh, yes, sure. Because, well, it's because I take now twice a month an injection of testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I would lose my sex drive. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yeah. Now, when you were first castrated, obviously you didn't have a prescription to testosterone.
No. But after a month or a month and a half after the castration, I started to get hot flashes.
Mm-hmm. What are those like?
Oh, it's very annoying. You feel it coming up. There's a climax, and then it goes away, and then your forehead is covered with sweat, the same as your chest, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's very annoying because they can occur about every hour, mm-hmm. 24 hours a day, no matter where you are, and it's very annoying.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take testosterone, you don't have that.
So then you went to your doctor?
Oh, yes. And I went to my family doctor. He was looking after me because I was HIV positive.
Mm-hmm.
And I just told him that I had been castrated. And he looked at me and he said, "Well, Marcel," he said, "you're old enough to know what you're doing." Mm-hmm. So, right. I said, "I don't like those hot flashes." He says, "Well, we will start now giving you a testosterone injection." Mm-hmm. And we start right now, and it's going to be once a month.
And then you were back to normal, I guess.
Absolutely. Everything after a week, there was no more hot flashes, and my sex drive was just like before, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And then after the penectomy, you had your scrotum removed?
Yes. The penectomy, as I said, was in May of 1994. So at the end of January 1995, right, I had the scrotum removed.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very simple procedure. It took about only 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that your photos with the penectomy, but the scrotum still there, has led to a lot of fantasy people thinking that it was
yes.
just the penis removed.
Well, I didn't like the look, you know, because sometimes it looks like a pussy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one time I was in Montreal at a nude beach, and I was sunbathing, and two girls walked by and they looked at me and they started to laugh, probably because they thought I was a transsexual, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
you had the scrotum removed, but
yeah,
you had another procedure after that still, actually another two.
Yes. And what was it, I think it's May 1998, I had my nipples removed because they were absolutely big and ugly. Over the years, they have been abused so many times and tortured and burned, so they look absolutely ugly.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked my cutter if it was feasible to remove them. Oh, he says, "No problem there."
Mm-hmm.
So I just went to see him, and then it took about, not more than 5 minutes each nipple to be removed.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he used again xylocaine as anesthetic, and there was absolutely no pain. And after 1 week, the stitches came off. And then after 2 or 3 weeks, the healing was complete, was
mm-hmm.
over.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then you had one last procedure that was a lot rougher than the rest
of
them.
Oh, yes. I had the last procedure done. And then that took about...
Well, actually, what was the last procedure?
Well, the removal of the stump
mm-hmm.
and the relocation of the urethra.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the point of that was to make it a real smooth,
yes,
finished off look.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And that was a long procedure, 5.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and deep inside your body,
right?
You know, a pretty hefty procedure.
Yeah,
healing was a lot tougher.
Oh yeah, the healing took about over a month, maybe a month and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And I'm still not happy because the urethra is not close enough to the anus, mm-hmm. and I pee at a 45-degree angle, and it should go straight down into the toilet bowl, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the scar is all crooked, you know, and there's a lump of skin where the stump was before, and it shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't look very pretty to me. Anyway, mm-hmm. I'm not too happy about it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that you'll have further operations to clean that up? Or?
Yes, I'm just waiting to, through my contacts in here in USA, Canada, and Europe to find an urologist which would relocate my urethra about 2 inches or 10 centimeters from the anus. And then I will look for a plastic surgeon, you know, to make the crotch very, very smooth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not in a rush. I'm just waiting, you know, to meet the right person.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, you're also covered in gorgeous custom tribal tattoo work. That's a combination of the artist's designs and your feedback.
Yeah. Well, I must say tattoos are very addicting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You start with one, and then after a while you want another one, and so on. I had my first tattoo, probably 15 years ago, a panther on my left arm with my name, then an eagle on my right arm, and then a tiger and a fish on my upper back.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was it for a few years. And then when I discovered the tribal design or drawings, it looked so nice. I started to go tribal. And slowly I had the ankle band in tribal around my two ankles. And then I had my left leg, thigh, and I would say leg.
Mm-hmm.
With the nice tribal. And then I met a guy, and he loved tattoo as well. And he started creating those designs on his computer.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how I had my chest, abdominal, crotch, and my whole back and my butt done on a computer, customized for me from, you know, from that guy.
Mm-hmm. Now, tattoo artists are traditionally, politically conservative people as far as body modifications go. Did any of them notice that there wasn't, quite as much down there as some of their other clients?
Yes, right. Only the tattooists here in Toronto knows about it.
Mm-hmm.
The other ones, no, they I'm sorry, the guy in Montreal, the tattooist in Montreal who did my crotch.
He must have noticed.
Yes, I told him.
Mm-hmm. How did they respond?
Oh, very well.
I guess they knew you at that point. So.
Well, he knew that I told him there was something missing there, but it didn't seem to bother him at all.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't see anything, though. You know, mm-hmm. But he could see that there was nothing down there.
All right, we're going to play some Brian Eno from Another Green World. And when we come back, I want to talk to Marcel about some of the recent political changes there have been in the eunuch scene.
And I were tired. We had walked and we had scrambled through the moors and through the briars, through the endless blue meanders in the blue August noon. In the cool August noon. Over the nights and through the fires, we went surging down the wires, through the towns and on the highways, through the storms in all their thundering. The blue August noon, in the cool August noon. saw St. Elmo's fire spitting ions in the ether.
All right, Marcel, I want to ask you a little bit more about coming out. While you've always been really open through through magazines like Unique, but recently you've been outing yourself a lot more and in more and more publicly accessible media. A couple others, Gelding, for example, have been doing the same, especially in the light of recent convictions of Dr. Brown and Ed Botkin. Why do you feel secure in doing this?
I feel secure because in my mind I have nothing to hide, you know. And, well, first of all, I'm retired and not working anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't care, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But
I want to be exposed.
Right. But it's a community that undertakes, you know, I'm not going to say whether it's illegal behavior or not, but it's certainly... You know, the activity of doing these procedures is certainly questionable as far as the legality of it. And I worry maybe that some of this media attracts undue attention, and if people are very easy to track down, you know, how does that... do you think that the cutters will go more underground now, or...?
I'm afraid they will.
Mm-hmm.
That's my belief, you know, and because of... let's put it this way, it's illegal, and it should be made... only by expert, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the cutters, I know, they keep a very low profile.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they don't mind doing minor modification like a sub-incision. But as far as castration is concerned and penectomy, they are just petrified, you know. They are very, very scared, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because, let's put it this way, you always take a chance, even for a castration. And like it happened in the past, if something goes wrong,
mm-hmm.
it's beyond your, or something beyond your control, you have to go to hospital.
And that happens even to the best cutters.
And then if the police is involved, then you might be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I know that happened once in California and another... time in somewhere in Texas, a guy was castrated, but what he didn't say before the castration, he drank about 3 or 4 beers,
mm-hmm.
which he should have not done.
But thinned his blood out.
Oh, yeah. So when the cutter left, everything seemed fine. And after it was gone, the internal bleeding started.
Mm-hmm.
And the scrotum became the size of a grapefruit.
Mm-hmm.
So that was pretty scary. And that guy, he lived in a small town somewhere in Texas. He drove to Houston. And then with the help of a friend, they went to see a gay doctor and they took care of him.
Discreetly.
Discreetly,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
but it's not always.
I guess at least a good thing about the mainstreaming of this is that the public in general, doctors included, are realizing that it's, you know, it may be okay, you know, it may be an all right practice. But the other worry, I mean, most of the eunuchs up until recently have been much older when they've been getting castrated. But now there's a more of a youth interest, and younger people are starting to approach cutters. What do you think that people need to think about before they actually go through with this?
Well, before a young person, let's say 25, 30 years old, has a castration, I think he should, how would say that? He should be aware, you know, of the effects of a castration, how his life will be changed. And I think he should think of it like I did me, although I was 55. He should think of it for at least 3, 4, 5 years before really doing the real procedure.
Mm-hmm.
That's my advice.
What change does it make to your life, though, if you're taking hormones?
Well,
or is there more of a there's a psychological effect as well?
No. In my case, there was no psychological effect because my life was just normal, just like before.
Mm-hmm.
But for a young person, I think they should think twice before doing it because once it's gone forever, you know.
Mm-hmm. That said, if you could change things, would you have done this younger or?
No. I really enjoyed myself when I had all my parts and I had my pleasure, and then I'm happy the way I am now.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
One of the guys in BME's interview section, Jay, in the sub-incision, said the same thing. He didn't do his sub-incision until he was, I think, 45, 55. And he said as well, you know, I'm glad I waited until then because, you know, now I've experienced sex on all these different levels. And I'm, you know, if I'd done it when I was a kid, I wouldn't appreciate it quite as much.
Yes, that's right. I had, well, this is my, I'm exactly like that too. I had a very nice sex life, and then I was due for a change. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll ask you again about the media thing. Recently, there have been articles both in Details magazine and in GQ magazine speaking, when it comes down to it, very positively about castration. Is this a surprise to you that the public would react in this way?
Yes, it's a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
I was not expecting that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was really surprised that GQ would be interested in publishing an article on that. And also, you didn't mention the National Post in Toronto, which there's a big picture of me showing my tattoos. It was taken in my living room. And then with the article about the tattoos, there is an article, too, about body modification, especially castration. And it's about a man called Frank, and who is retired. And well, for people who know me, they know exactly that Frank and Marcel of the from the you know, showing his tattoos are really the same person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really surprised the National Post would do that too.
Mm-hmm. And your email address is very publicly posted on BME and in Tom's Yahoo Club.
Yep. Yep.
What sort of feedback have you been getting from the public?
Well, very positive feedback, because all the email I get about that, guys are absolutely turned on by what they see, and they would like the same procedure done to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's very positive.
Do you think they're for real, or do you think they're fantasy?
Well, I guess they are real, and it's also a fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And if I detect that it's a fantasy, well, I say to them, well, think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do anything. Just think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Just like me.
Yeah. And now you've been at a number of procedures done by your cutter. What are the various different reasons people go into this for? I mean, yours was a direct extension of your sexual play.
Yes.
But that's not the same for everybody.
Well, some people, they just want to be, especially I'm talking about the bottom people, they want to prove their masters, you know, by something tangible.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And other people, Well, I don't think I have to explain that. I just don't know what to say about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's just say there's a million different reasons people do it, and they're all valid reasons, and you know, as long as the people have thought about them for an extended period of time and really are sure that this is what they want, then that's good.
This is my advice to all of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And do you think that this is a procedure that hopefully in a few years will start being done by the medical community, or?
I hope so.
I mean, it almost looks like it's moving in that direction.
Yes, it's going to take time, though. Probably, I think in the United States, the doctors are less open than they are here in mm-hmm. you know, in Canada. But hopefully, well,
I'm sure there'll be a screening process like with transsexuals. But
yes,
but that's probably a good thing.
Yeah, I have a good example of that after the. Urethral relocation, my crutch was swollen, and I went to a hospital here in Toronto, and then I had a doctor, a urologist student, looking at that, and then he asked me a question, why I did that, and so on, and then he called his boss, you know, if you want, the urologist in charge, you know, of the department, and he came, and he looked at that, and... he said, why did you do that? And he says, by the way, do you need the help of a psychiatrist?
Yeah, psychiatrist.
Psychiatrist. I said, no. And then he says, do you mind if I call my staff to see what you've done? I said, I don't care. Bring your staff if you want. So there we have about six persons, men and women, you know, and looking at my modification and very curious. But they were not shocked.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure the only shock for them was seeing a sane individual.
Exactly.
You know, that has done these things.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, we've run out of time for today. Those of you that want to know more about this subject can visit eunuch.org or find out some more in BME Extreme as well. In addition, you can email Marcel at nullo1@hotmail.com. That's nullo and the number one, not the word. And thanks for being here, Marcel, and we'll see you all next week. And finishing off the show is some Dr. Octagon.
Why does she have to know that? I couldn't deal with Kelly Kristansky. And when I attacked her, she didn't at first realize what was happening. It didn't go through. She was ready to recover all of us. It knocked her right up into the lid of the car. But it didn't pierce the clothing. Once that fell, I had a mic. When I bought her, the pawn shop, she was nice. I was getting easier. I was getting better at it. I was getting less detectable. I started flaunting that invisibility, severing a human head, two of them, at night in front of my mother's residence, with her at home, my neighbors at home upstairs, their picture window open, the curtains open, 11 o'clock at night, the lights are on, all they have to do is walk by, look out, and I've had it.